I didn't really finish what I was planning on getting to last lecture, so I thought I would just mainly spend this lecture completing the story that I was telling last time. So, first I'd like to review what I did last time. So, our starting point was A, being a cohomology theory that we wanted to define equivariant versions of. So our first thing we're going to do is assume that A is not just a cohomology theory, but it's a cohomology theory with a good multiplicative structure. It's representable by an E-infinity ring spectrum. And then we can do algebraic geometry over A. That's the theme of this series of lectures. So we're going to start with some geometry over A, and we're going to use it to build equivariant versions of the cohomology theory A. So the geometry that we need to start with is a group scheme G defined over spec A. And when I say group scheme, I'm always going to mean a very commutative group scheme in the sense that I defined earlier. It represents a functor from A algebras to topological abelian groups. And one other piece of data that we needed was what I called a free orientation, which is a pointed map from the two-sphere into the A points of the group scheme G. Okay, starting with this data, we did various constructions. So if T was a compact abelian Lie group, we defined G sub T to be Hom's from the Pontryagin dual group into G. So that is a derived A scheme. It's actually a derived, it actually has a group structure also. And roughly speaking, this is going to be arranged so that functions, global functions on this group scheme, was going to give us the T-equivariant A cohomology of a point. And if we wanted to define the T-equivariant A cohomology of more general T spaces, well, we were going to take global sections not of the structure sheaf of G sub T, but of some quasi-coherent sheaf on G sub T. So cohomology is going to be a composition of two operations. First, we're going to have some functor that takes T spaces to quasi-coherent sheaves. Let me mention this is going to be a contravariant functor. And then, if you want to get out a cohomology spectrum, you should take the global sections of those quasi-coherent sheaves. And if you wanted to get cohomology groups, you should then extract the homotopy groups of that spectrum. Okay, so we defined this functor F sub T, or rather we described the functor F sub T that we wanted. We wanted it to satisfy three axioms. So the first axiom was some sort of excision or Meyer-Vieth-Torres property that F sub T carries homotopy colimits of T spaces to homotopy limits of quasi-coherent sheaves. The second property is some kind of compatibility as we change group from T to T prime. Well, T-equivariant cohomology and T-prime equivariant cohomology should be related. They should be related to one another by some sort of induction procedure that you can use to pass from T-spaces to T-prime spaces. And finally, we didn't want the whole theory to be trivial, so we normalized it so that if we take the T-equivariant cohomology of a point, we do indeed get global sections of the actual structure sheaf on G sub T. And I gave a sketch of an argument that there's a more or less unique way to define these functors F sub T so that these three conditions are satisfied. Okay, so this is where I want to start. This time, I'd just like to talk some more about these functors F sub T, talk some more about this whole picture. Okay, so the first thing that I'd like to talk about is this notion of a pre-orientation. So as it stands, there's going to be lots of pre-orientations. Of course, you can always find pointed maps from a two-sphere into a pointed space. For example, you could take the trivial map, which just collapses this two-sphere to the base point of G of A. So that's a pre-orientation, but it's not a very interesting one. It's in some sense trivial, and that should be reflected in the fact that, you know, the cohomology theories that you produce are not, these equivariant cohomology theories are not going to be so great. So what I'd like to do is put a sort of non-triviality condition on a pre-orientation that will guarantee that we produce something more interesting. So, you would get something pretty uninteresting, I think. I mean, it won't be, for example, you won't be able to promote it to an actual G spectrum in the sense of equivariant cohomology theories. You won't be able to define a cohomology theory that is graded by the representations of G. So I'll come back to that in a little while. That's going to require this non-degeneracy condition. Okay, so definition. So let G and A be as above, and let eta be a pre-orientation Well, so before we get to the definition, let me just use this pre-orientation to extract some data from this situation. Okay, so let me just sort of do this. Well, so this induces a map. This gives an A to the S2 valued point of G. At least if G is affine. And in the situations that we'll be interested in, it will give an A to the S2 valued point of G even when G is not affine. But if you imagine that G is spec B, what I'm saying is an A valued point of G then is just a ring homomorphism, or an E infinity ring spectrum homomorphism from B to A. And if I have pre-orientation, it's not just one A-valued point of G, but a whole family of points, A-valued points of G, indexed by the two-sphere. So that's a whole two-spheres worth of maps from B into A, which I can arrange or encapsulate in a single map from B into the function spectrum A to the S2. So now let G bar be the underlying ordinary scheme. Of G. So then this A to the S2 valued point of G gives a pi naught of A to the S2 valued point of G bar, just by passing from derived schemes to ordinary schemes by taking pi naught of all of the relevant rings. So now pi naught of A to the S2, this is just pi naught of A direct sum pi 2 of A. If I have a map from S2 into A, well, the first thing I can ask is where the base point goes. It goes into some connected component, and once I've fixed where the base point goes, it's a pointed map from the two-sphere in, and those are classified by pi 2 of A. And this is actually an isomorphism of commutative rings, where the commutative ring structure here is given by forming a trivial square zero extension. That is, it uses the ring structure on pi 0 of A and the structure of pi 2 of A as a module over pi 0 of A. So what we have is now a map in ordinary algebraic geometry from spec of pi naught of A direct sum spec pi 2 of A. Spec of this direct sum into G bar. Now, so far I haven't used the fact that eta was a pointed map. If I use the fact that eta is a pointed map, then what I deduce is that if I restrict this to spec pi naught A, that's a closed subscheme here, what I'm supposed to get is a pi naught a valued point of g bar, which just corresponds to the identity with respect to the group structure on g bar. Okay, so let me continue the definition now. Eta is an orientation if, well, first let me assume that this is, if this underlying ordinary group scheme is smooth over pi naught of A. So G is sort of smooth in some derived sense. It's a derived version of something which is classically smooth. Now, if this is smooth, in the case where G bar is smooth, this is, you can think of as sort of an infinitesimal deformation of the identity section of G. And it's classified, so let me call this map something. Let me call this psi. So now, parenthetically, once we know that G bar is smooth, psi is classified by a map from the Lie algebra of G bar into, the dual of the Lie algebra into pi 2 of A. So this translation is just more or less taking the sort of modern algebra geometric definitions of tangent spaces and cotangent spaces and plugging in this situation here. So now, condition number two, in order for eta to be an orientation, is that this map should induce isomorphisms from this. We have this map from the dual of the Lie algebra of G into pi 2, and then using the ring structure that we have on the collection of all homotopy groups of A, that gives us a map from this dual Lie algebra tensor pi n into pi n plus 2, and our requirement is going to be that this is an isomorphism. That also, yes, we require this for all n, including n equals 0. So, for example, if n is equal to minus 2, then we're saying that the dual of the Lie algebra tensored with pi minus 2a should be isomorphic to pi naught of a, and this implies that the Lie algebra of G is locally free of rank 1. This implies that G is one-dimensional. It also implies that pi minus 2 of A is locally free of rank 1 over pi naught of A. And then locally on pi naught of A, what we're really saying here is that this is a sort of a periodicity statement. If we were to trivialize this Lie algebra, this is just saying that we have some kind of isomorphism between pi n of A and pi n plus 2 of A. So, locally, get a sort of periodicity map . So I'll denote this by beta, and beta is supposed to remind you of the bot element. This is some kind of form of bot periodicity. So an orientation is going to be a pre-orientation satisfying a condition, and that condition you can think of as sort of an abstract form of the bot periodicity theorem. But I'd like to give you a couple of other ways of thinking about what an orientation does. So remember that a pre-orientation, we can think of it as a pointed map from a two-sphere into G of A that's just a map of pointed spaces, or originally we thought of it as a map from CP infinity into the G points of A that was a map of topological abelian groups. Now, in this language, what's going on, how should you think about what this map is doing? Well, as before, you can think about this as defining a map from sort of a spec of A to the CP infinity into G. Or if I had a single map, suppose I had a single map from A into G. Well, this induces a map from global functions on G back into A, just by restricting my functions along this map. Now, in this situation, we don't have a single map, but we have a whole family of maps parameterized by CP infinity. So I get a whole family of maps from global functions on G to A, which I can encode in a single map from global functions on G to the function spectrum A to the CP infinity. And now, what is this map? Well, global functions on G, more or less by the story that was motivating us the whole time, functions on G, this is supposed to recover the S1 equivariant A cohomology of a point. And now, this restriction map, functions on G, goes to A to the CP infinity. Well, this is, CP infinity is the classifying space for S1, and this we can think of as the Borel equivariant S1 cohomology of a point. And this map here is just the map that you would always have from any equivariant cohomology theory to the equivariant cohomology theory given by the Borel construction. So this, I'll call this the Atiyah-Siegel map, because this is the map which, in the case where A is complex K-theory, the Atiyah-Siegel theorem tells you something about. So, theorem of Atiyah and Siegel is in complex K-theory this map is almost an isomorphism. I'll just say in words, this map is supposed to exhibit the left-hand side as a suitable completion of the right-hand side with respect to the augmentation ideal. All right, but now in general, we have no reason to expect that this map that we produced here would be so interesting. So, for example, if we were to choose a very boring pre-orientation, like the trivial map, well, this map is also going to be very boring, because this map to A to the CP infinity would just factor through A. So, so boring pre-orientations give boring Atiyah-Siegel maps. So to get an Atiyah-Siegel theorem, we need to assume eta is interesting. And interesting, it turns out, translates more or less precisely into this definition that I've given over here. So, claim, well, if eta is an orientation, then you get an Atiyah-Siegel theorem, in some sense. You can prove a version of the Atiyah-Siegel theorem in this context, and in some sense, there's a converse to that. If you, the Atiyah-Siegel theorem, in maybe a less precise sense, is really equivalent to the condition that the preorientation eta that we're using to define these equivariant cohomology theories be an orientation. So one way that you can think about this condition of being orientation is that it's a version of the Bott periodicity theorem. Another way you can think about it is it's an abstract version of the Atiyah-Siegel completion theorem. Okay, so now I would like to give demonstrate the utility of this condition that eta be an orientation. Actually, I'm going to use a little bit less than that. I'm just going to use these sorts of conclusions that I drew, these one-dimensionality conditions that we got on G bar. But I'd like to see how this would play out and also see, just sort of in an example, what some of these sheaves F sub T would look like. So, right. So in particular, it's geared so that if you have this data over A and you have any map of E infinity ring spectra from A to B, then you also get this data over B. But in all of the sorts of universal examples that we'll come to, the odd homotopy groups will be zero. Okay, so what I mentioned over here on this board that we get equivariant versions of the cohomology theory A, but we get equivariant versions only in a weak sense. That is, so using F sub T, we can define, say, A sub N sub T of X to be pi minus n of the global sections over G sub T of F sub T of X. And this is a reasonable definition for the T equivariant A cohomology of X. But typically when you're doing equivariant stable homotopy theory, you demand a little bit more than this. You demand that not only can you do you get cohomology groups that are indexed by integers, they're you get cohomology groups that are indexed by representations of the group T that you're working over. So in this situation, you don't necessarily get that. You don't get that if you only assume that eta is a preorientation, but you do get it if you assume that eta is an orientation. So I would like to sort of explain how that goes. So let V be a representation of T. And now, the units, let me say, complex Hermitian representation of T. So the unit sphere of V is going to be the set of vectors such that they have norm 1, and the unit ball of V is going to be the set of vectors have norm less than or equal to 1. Oh, and let me just mention one other thing. If we have T acting on a space X, and we have T acting on a space Y, and we have a map between X and Y, say an inclusion of Y and X, then we can define a quasi-coherent sheaf F sub T x relative to y to be the kernel of the map, the induced map from f sub t of x to f sub t of y. So this kernel, or if you prefer the word fiber, the homotopy fiber of this map. So we have a good definition for relative cohomology groups as well. Okay, so now I'm going to define L sub V to be F sub T of the unit ball relative to the unit sphere. So this is a quasi-coherent sheaf on G sub T. Oh, there's one other thing that I should mention also, is that these definitions are rigged so that F sub T is sort of a multiplicative functor. So one of the properties that F sub T has is that there's a natural map from F sub T of x tensored with F sub T of y into F sub T of the product x times y. This is where products on cohomology would come from in this context. Okay, so now I want to make two claims about L sub V. So first claim is that L sub V is a line bundle on G sub T. It's an invertible sheaf. And claim number two is that, say, for all x with an action of t, the canonical map f sub t of x tensored with L sub v. Using this map up here, we can build a map from f sub t of x cross tensored with L of v to f sub t of sort of x smashed with this inclusion here, that is f sub t of x cross the unit ball relative to x cross the unit sphere. And the claim is that this map is an isomorphism. Okay, so these are two claims about L of V, that is, if eta is an orientation. In general, these claims are not going to be true. So now, what is the use of these statements? What do these buy us? Well, so here we have a definition of the A cohomology of T, the T equivariant cohomology of X, A cohomology of X for any X. And now if we have, say, V, a representation of T, what we find is that the T equivariant A cohomology of the suspension of x with respect to the representation of v, this is given by the global sections, or the homotopy groups of the global sections over g sub t of L sub v tensored with f sub t of x. So this is just a reformulation of statement 2 here. But now the point is that given statement 1, this also makes sense for minus v. We can now define the equivariant cohomology of a formal desuspension of x to be the homotopy groups of the global sections over g sub t. Well, instead of tensoring with the line bundle L sub v, we'll do the opposite. We'll tensor with the inverse of L sub V. And this makes sense because L sub T is a line bundle. It's invertible. And therefore, we get, maybe after some work, or some work of a very formal nature, an honest equivariant spectrum representing these cohomology functors A sub T. Okay, so I'm not going to prove all of this claim. I'll just prove part one of the claim because it's going to illustrate how, well, it's going to illustrate concretely this argument that we used, that these three axioms determined F sub T. That is, using those axioms, we'll just carry out the calculation to figure out what L sub V looks like in this case. Okay, so what do we have to do? Okay, so we want to prove something about L sub V, namely that it's a line bundle. So here V is some representation of a compact abelian Lie group T. So step one is we can reduce to the case where V is irreducible. And really, in some sense, that reduction should use part two here. Is if we had what we're saying is that if V is a direct sum of two things, then we're essentially trying to prove something about the sphere corresponding to V, and that sphere would be a smash product of the spheres corresponding to the two sum ends, and then this assertion would let us reduce to proving something about those two sum ends individually. And now, since T is abelian, this implies that V is one-dimensional. And that V determines a character of T. T mapping to S1 sitting inside the complex, invertible complex numbers. So step two, reduce to the case where T is equal to the circle and V is the canonical representation. That is, what we're saying here is that the whole problem sort of comes from the basic one-dimensional representation of S1, and therefore we can reduce to the case where T is S1 acting on that one-dimensional representation. Okay. Step three, calculate. So F sub T of the unit ball relative to the unit sphere, well, what I said is that that fits into an exact triangle where here we have F sub T of the unit ball and here we have F sub T of the unit sphere. Okay, but now V is just the complex numbers being acted on by the circle via rotations. So now the unit ball, this is just a disk in the complex plane, and the disk is S1 equivariantly contractible to the origin. So this here is just equivalent to F sub T of a point, which is, by axiom 3, that's just supposed to be the structure sheaf on G sub T. Here T is a circle, so G sub T is just the group G that we are interested in. So this term in the middle is just going to be the structure sheaf of the group G. What about F sub T of the unit sphere? Well, the unit sphere in the complex numbers, that's just a circle, and it's being acted on by a circle And that's just the circle acting on itself by translations. So this is f sub s1 of s1. And here we should use axiom 2. S1 as an S1 space is induced from a point as a space with an action of the trivial group. And so what this would tell us is that this is supposed to be pushed forward from F of the trivial group acting on a point. Now, what map are we pushing forward along? Well, we have an inclusion of the trivial group into S1, and this induces a map from spec A into G, spec A being G of the trivial group, and G being G of S1. And this map here is just the identity of G. And now F sub a point of a point, well, that's again a special case of 3, now when T is a point. This is just supposed to be the structure sheaf of spec A. So what we see here is that here we have the structure sheaf of G. And now inside G, we have this closed subscheme corresponding to the identity element. And here we're just supposed to push forward the structure sheaf of that closed subscheme. So now what's the fiber of that map? Well, this is, you can think of as the ideal sheaf of functions on G that vanish at the identity. And now what we're trying to prove, I said we want to prove something about L sub V. What we wanted to prove about it was that it was a line bundle. So we want G to be a group such that if we take functions that vanish at the identity, we get a line bundle. Well, that's more or less equivalent to requiring that G be one-dimensional. So this is just a sample of where the condition that a pre-orientation be an orientation gets applied. Okay. So now let's talk about let's now do an example. So the example which motivated this whole story at the very beginning was the case where A was complex K-theory. That is, we looked at the S1 equivariant K-theory of a point, and we saw that it looked like functions on an algebraic group, namely the multiplicative group. So what I'd like to do now is start from the other end. So let's choose an interesting G. See what we get. Okay, so first idea, choose G to be the multiplicative group GM. So now, over Z, or over any ordinary commutative ring, GM is defined to be the spectrum of a Laurent polynomial ring Z adjoined U and U inverse. And now, observation, this makes sense for any, or say over, any E infinity ring A. That is, we can define GM over spec A. GM here is just going to be, by definition, a spec of what I can write informally as A adjoined U and U inverse, or a little bit less informally, I might call this A adjoined Z. It's the group algebra where my coefficients are in A, and the group is the group of integers, or this is what a homotopy theorist would write as A smashed with Z plus. No, because there's no map from the integers to A usually. Like, A could be the sphere second. Oh, there's a map from. Well, so the integers are an example of an A. Oh, yeah. So ordinary schemes are a special case of this. A could be a discrete commutative ring. This is well defined. So there's a universal multiplicative group defined over the sphere, and it base changes to all of these. But the one over the sphere is not going to be the one that's most interesting from our point of view. Because remember, we don't just need an algebraic group. We also need an algebraic group equipped with either pre-orientation, or if we really want to get to work, we need it to be an orientation. So now let's take this algebraic group, which is defined over any A, and see what it takes to give it a pre-orientation and an orientation. Yes? Yeah, so that's worth some mention here. So this is maybe a little bit of a technical point. So this is not the functor that would be most directly related to that. So, well, it's very closely related to that functor. So let me, so there's another group scheme, which is sort of, I'll denote by GL1. So GL1 of A, well, GL1 is a group scheme. It represents a functor from A to from algebras to spaces. So let me say what this thing is as a space. This is the subspace of the underlying space of A, omega infinity A, or if you don't like that notation, just think A itself, consisting of points X, which determine invertible elements in pi naught A. So now, this guy, so GL1 is also an affine derived scheme. So this is spec of the sphere, what I'll write as the sphere adjoin U and U inverse. But now I'm adjoining U in a slightly different sense. To get this functor, what I should do is take the free E infinity ring spectrum over U on one generator, and then invert that generator. So that does not coincide with this group algebra. This is also something that you could write. This is like the group algebra over the sphere, where the group is not the group of integers, but the group is instead the like the zeroth space of the sphere itself. So now this is a group scheme, but this is not fully commutative in the sense of these other group schemes being fully commutative. That is, here I defined it as a space-valued functor. It's actually an infinite loop space-valued functor, but it cannot be refined to a functor which takes values in topological abelian groups. So it's not as commutative as this group scheme GM. So you can think there's a relationship between these guys. So there exists a functor, or a map, from GM into GL1, and this is universal with respect to fully commutative group schemes mapping to GL1. Or another way of saying it is that GM of A this is Hom's of a spectra from the integers into GL1 of A. It's the universal, it's in some sense what you get if you take GL1 of A and try and, in some universal way, promote it to something which is more strictly commutative. Okay. So now, let's consider this GM defined over spec A. When do we get a preorientation? Well, remember, a preorientation is a map eta from CP infinity into GM of A. And now, by some kind of adjointness, well, mapping CP infinity into this sort of multiplicative group, this is the same thing as giving a map from the group algebra of CP infinity, or this is what a homotopy theorist would write as the sphere smashed with CP infinity joint and disjoint base points. But this is the same thing as giving a map from this group algebra into A. Now here, this was a map of topological abelian groups. And here, this is a map of E infinity ring spectra. Okay, so that's exactly what it takes to put a preorientation on the multiplicative group. The multiplicative group is defined over A. You have to map a particular E infinity ring into A. Or in other words, spec of this group algebra represents the functor of preorientations on the multiplicative group. Okay, so that answers the question for preorientations. Preorientations are classified by this data. Now let's ask the question, when is eta an orientation? Well, we go back to the definition. What does it take to be an orientation? Well, first of all, the underlying ordinary group scheme should be smooth over pi naught of A. Well, that's automatic because we know what the multiplicative group looks like classically. It looks like the usual multiplicative group. Now, this map should induce certain isomorphisms, so that's some kind of a periodicity statement. So what we should do is try and figure out what this map from the Lie algebra into pi 2 of A looks like. So what is that Lie algebra? Well, the Lie algebra of the usual multiplicative group is just canonically trivial. So this is really classified by just an element in pi 2 of A, and what element is that? Well, I'll just tell you the answer. That element, you can think of the 2-sphere as CP1, which sits inside CP infinity, and then this maps to the group algebra of CP infinity, and then that maps to A if I have a preorientation. And this composition gives me a map from a 2-sphere into A, or I can think of it as an element in pi 2 of A. And that's the element which corresponds to this derivative here. And so the condition, so eta is an orientation, if and only if this element gives me periodicity isomorphisms, or if and only if beta is invertible in pi star A. So beta has an inverse, which lives in pi minus 2A. As a what? Mm-hmm. Yes. Front and pi 2 of A. Yeah. All right. So now what's going on? Right. So now pre-orientations. GM are classified, or sorry, orientations of GM are now classified by maps from the suspension spectrum of CP infinity adjoin an inverse to this element beta. So there's a universal preorientation of the multiplicative group over this guy, which gives us a universal beta that's just classified by this composition. So orientations are classified by E infinity ring maps from this E infinity ring spectrum into A. And now there's an old theorem of Victor Snaith, which is that if you take the suspension spectrum of CP infinity and invert the Bott element, what you get is precisely complex K theory. So what is this telling us? Well, we started with complex K-theory, and we saw that there was a story kind of like this, where equivariant complex K-theory has something to do with the multiplicative group. And then we forgot about that, and we just thought about the multiplicative group itself. We thought about what it would take to build an equivariant cohomology theory out of the multiplicative group. Well, what it would take is precisely an orientation in this sense, and when can we provide that orientation? Well, it's precisely when we are working over complex K-theory, or more generally over some ring spectrum with a homomorphism from complex K-theory. So this gives us a definition of complex K-theory that has nothing to do with complex vector bundles. So we could just start out thinking algebra-geometrically, think about the multiplicative group and the problem of providing an orientation, and that gives us a universal property that complex K-theory has in this world of E-infinity ring spectra, which apparently has nothing to do with the picture of complex K-theory, the geometric picture, as something which is telling us about vector bundles. So, conclusion, this formalism produces equivariant versions of complex K theory. And you can probably guess that what happens is that it produces precisely the usual definition of equivariant complex K-theory. Usually, that's defined by thinking about equivariant vector bundles, but from this point of view, it's defined just using sort of algebra-geometric picture, thinking about quasi-coherent sheaves on these sort of algebraic tori defined over spec K. So we have to take T equivariant. And now as a comment, with a little more effort, get also G equivariant versions for non-abelian G. So I think I'm just about out of time now. I'll stop there.
Questions? So if you start with a complex-orientable homology theory, which is periodic, and such a formal group is the completion of some classical algebraic tree, then does this definition coincide with the, or does it not coincide, or is it stronger or weaker? Somehow you could find out.
Well, if you have this data, then in particular, the underlying cohomology theory is complex orientable, and this orientation has something to do with the complex orientation. But the problem of, you know, taking, you could take a complex oriented cohomology theory and take an algebraic group and then ask, you know, can you sort of assemble it into this picture where, you know, you promote the complex oriented cohomology theory to an E infinity ring spectrum, you promote the algebraic group to an algebraic group which is defined over that E infinity ring spectrum, and hope for the best. And now, this is not something that comes about formally, but it's something that comes about in certain very interesting examples. So, for example, for, say, ordinary K theory and the multiplicative group, well, what this is, if you just think of ordinary K theory not as an E infinity ring spectrum, but just as a cohomology theory, you know, you could ask, well, I see the formal multiplicative group here, I know about the usual multiplicative group, can I somehow define that over an E infinity version of K theory? And the answer, according to this result, or is that yes, you can, and there's a more or less unique way to do it. And this is also what happens in the case of elliptic cohomology, but it's not formal. It's some sort of, it's something that's a lot of work to prove. What's that? Well, I don't know any algebraic group that